It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Vickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today for Rob Ferret.
Coming up in half an hour, we'll take a look at dozens of tax breaks that expired at the end of 2013.
But right now, we're going to take a look at the new year and how we can take better care of the environment.
Beth Terry was happily consuming food, drinks, and products in plastic and feeling like that was fine because she would recycle it afterwards, at least sometimes.
But then she saw a photo that would change her life and her outlook. She's become committed to living a plastic-free lifestyle, and she's got some ideas to share with the rest of us. Beth, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me. Happy New Year.
Oh, and Happy New Year to you, too. Take us back to that moment when you saw that photo, and it's kind of a disturbing photo, actually, but it wound up sort of changing your life, changing your direction, and bringing us this book that we're going to be talking about.
Yeah. I kind of considered myself an environmentalist at that time because I gave money to environmental organizations and I recycled. But one night while I was browsing the internet, I stumbled on this photo. It was an article about plastic pollution in the ocean. And the photo was a dead albatross chick on Midway Island, which is halfway between the United States and Japan, thousands of miles from civilization. And the carcass of the bird was just full of everyday plastic, bottle caps, all kinds of things like I was using myself on a daily basis. And that was the first time that I actually made the connection between things I was using and things I was consuming and harm to other creatures and the environment. And I just, right then, I thought, I wonder what it would be like to try to live without acquiring any new plastic. You know, I didn't know if it was possible. I didn't know if I'd even want to keep doing it. But I thought, I'm just going to give this a shot and see if I can do it.
You know, I've been on an island kind of in that part of the world, and it is surprising, actually, how there's no people on the island, or very few people. But as you walk around places like that, plastic is everywhere. And if you take that remote island and sort of put it in the context of our everyday lives, plastic becomes an amazing force that we don't even think about.
Right. I was just this year on a beach in Hawaii, on Oahu, the northernmost tip of Oahu, and it's a wilderness preserve. It's a place where most people don't come. And I sat in the sand and I just scooped up handful after handful after handful of plastic, because it's all out there in the ocean. It runs off from the land. It accumulates in the ocean, and then in certain spots, it just washes up and accumulates. And that beach is one of them. There's a beach on another island in Hawaii, Midway. I had a friend who went to Midway, and he started on one beach at one point cleaning the beach, and by the time he was done, he went back to his original spot, and it was as if he hadn't done anything because there was so much plastic washing in.
Wow, that's kind of sobering. Well, it sounds like after you had your epiphany, you know, your first step was to look around you and identify the plastic that was involved in your life, some of it that you might not have been aware of. So where did you find plastic in your life, and what are some of those pockets of plastic that we don't even think about?
Well, I'll just say that first, the most obvious things were the plastic bags and the plastic bottles and the food wrappers. But, you know, as I would go through and eliminate different types of plastic from my life and find alternatives, I'd all of a sudden discover there was a source of plastic that I hadn't even realized. Like chewing gum, for example, is made out of plastic. The inside of metal bottle caps and jar lids is lined with plastic. Another thing I didn't know is that cardboard cartons and cups and, you know, milk, ice cream cartons, for example, anything that's cardboard that's leak-proof is lined in and out, inside and out, with plastic also. Plastic is just everywhere. It's ubiquitous. And I think in this, in our day and age, it's kind of difficult to completely live without plastic. I mean, I use a computer. I'm talking to you on a phone right now. But there are ways that we can significantly reduce it and reduce our plastic impact. And so I just wanted to find out what was possible.
I can't believe we're chewing plastic when we chew gum. I can't get over that one. Really? We're chewing plastic?
We are chewing plastic. There, I found a brand of gum that's only made in England, and it's only distributed in England, and it's made from a natural tree sap, and it also doesn't come in plastic packaging. So that's the other part of it. You know, there are a couple of natural gums, but they have disposable plastic packaging. There are gums that say that they're made with natural ingredients, but if you call what it turns out is that there's synthetic plastic mixed with the natural ingredients. So sometimes it's really hard to know what you're really getting.
And, you know, one of the big questions we've been hearing a lot about lately is plastic and its impact on our health in terms of, you know, things leaching out of water bottles and that sort of thing. Is there more research being done on that and more definitive answers that we're starting to get some handle on?
There's research being done constantly on that issue. Some of the chemicals in plastics that are of the most concern are hormone disruptors. They mimic hormones in the human body, and therefore they have been linked to various illnesses like obesity and diabetes and various cancers and developmental disorders. Every system that hormones regulate, these chemicals can affect. And it's very difficult to pinpoint a direct cause and effect between these chemicals because we're exposed to so many different chemicals on a daily basis. And it's that cumulative effect of so many different chemicals that's a problem. So the thing, though, that to keep in mind is that these hormone disruptors work at very, very tiny doses because it's at very small doses that the body thinks that they're hormones. And so it's not enough, you know, to say, well, you know, you're not being exposed to that much. It's not actually acutely toxic. That's true. But over time, those effects are accumulating. So I think it's important to reduce our exposure as much as we can.
Could you give us a quick sketch of plastics to avoid if we have any say in the matter?
Yeah, they're not all created equal. Although, I will say, first of all, let me just say that the worst ones, I think, are polyvinyl chloride, or PVC, which is number 3 plastic. That one contains phthalates, which are hormone disruptors. It may be stabilized with lead or cadmium or other heavy metals. It's a very difficult to recycle plastic, so number 3 is one to stay away from. Number 6 is polystyrene. And that's what styrofoam is made out of, but not only foam, it's also made into, you know, red Solo cups, for example, and disposable utensils are sometimes made from that. And styrene is a suspected carcinogen, and it's also difficult to recycle. But what many people don't realize is that in addition to the chemicals of concern that we're aware of, there are many, many, many additives put into plastics to affect the various qualities of the plastic, the strength and flexibility and stability and slipperiness, and even flame retardants are sometimes added, antibacterials are sometimes added. And plastics manufacturers are very reluctant to disclose the ingredients in their products, and they don't have to. They're not required to for proprietary reasons. So it's very difficult for us to know that a particular plastic is actually safe because we're not allowed to know what chemicals have been added to that plastic.
All right.
I was just going to say, even certain, quote, safe plastics have been shown to leach chemicals.
Okay. Beth Terry is the author of Plastic Free, How I Kicked the Plastic Habit, and How You Can Too.
And we want to hear from you on this. Do you think it's challenging to limit how much plastic you use? And is there a particular plastic container item that you can't imagine finding an alternative to? Beth Terry probably has some ideas to share about how to get plastics out of our lives.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Beth Terry challenged herself to limit or even eliminate plastic in her life. She's the author of Plastic Free, How I Kicked the Plastic Habit and How You Can Too. And she blogs at My Plastic Free Life.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. Are you motivated to get rid of plastic in your life? Do you have concerns about the amount of plastic that you use every single day? Are you surprised by the amount of plastic that you're surrounded by? Or do you think that life would just be too difficult to do without plastic? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can post comments on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, the phrase reduce, reuse, recycle, it's pretty well known, but Beth, you say that's not enough. Why?
Because I think that it's important for us to, well, first of all, I just want to say that those three, reduce, reuse, and recycle, those are in order, in that order on purpose, because recycling is the last of the R's. It's what we should consider after we've tried to reduce as much as we possibly can. reusing is important, but trying to eliminate plastics, unnecessary plastics, as much as possible, to me, is the best way to start, because we can't possibly recycle our way out of this. And most plastics are not actually recyclable, but instead are downcyclable, meaning that a bottle, for example, doesn't get recycled into another bottle, but into something like polar fleece or carpet or some secondary product that then doesn't normally get recycled. So it just ends up in the landfill, eventually anyway. So if we try to reduce as much as possible, that's great. And of course, I have a lot of other R's in my book, like remember. That's one of the strategies that I use, trying to find out what people did before plastic and use some of those strategies. There are several others that
You've got realize. Let's talk about realize.
Well, I think realizing is just realizing your impact and that everything we do makes a difference and that our personal actions can actually make a difference. I think a lot of people think that we only need big legislative changes, systemic changes, and that the decisions that we make in the grocery store every day aren't really going to make that much of a difference. But I disagree with that. I think we need laws changed, but we also need to take personal responsibility, and our personal actions can encourage other companies to make products that are healthier for us and have less plastic in them. And I've discovered lots and lots of really awesome companies making alternatives to plastic that I list in my book.
Well, let's talk about some of the specifics. I'm thinking about plastic water bottles. Those are still pretty popular. And people, I think, assume, they can recycle those water bottles. So it's not that big of an environmental cost. Or you look at the reusable Tupperware that has taken off recently, and it's plastic and it's reusable. It won't, last forever. They're not as sturdy as glass, but people rely on those a lot when they want to be able to send food home with some guests, for instance. What about plastic like that or packaging? How do we get rid of those?
Well, there's two different issues here. One is the waste issue, and when you're talking about something reusable, you're reducing waste by using those plastic reusables, actually, because you're not using something that someone's just going to throw away. But you have to also consider those chemicals that we talked about before that can leach out of them. And so there are great alternatives. There are stainless steel containers. When we have dinner parties or when our friends have dinner parties, they'll often encourage guests to bring a container with them so they can take home leftovers. And that's exactly what happened on Thanksgiving this year. Water bottles, if you're talking about disposable water bottles, they get downcycled. They don't get truly recycled, and they do have chemicals that can leach out of them. Reusable plastic water bottles, I wouldn't necessarily use either because of those chemicals. But there are stainless steel water bottles. There are glass water bottles. There are all kinds of great alternatives that people can use instead of plastic.
You talked earlier about the idea of, in your R's, about remembering how we used to do things.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, in 2013, 2014 now, I guess, how it is having that discussion with somebody who might be, 20 or 25 or 30 years old, who literally may not remember how we used to do things.
Yeah. Well, and, I'm 48 years old, and there is a lot of stuff that I don't remember, too. And I have conversations with my mother-in-law all the time about how she used to do things and how she still does things. She's never used plastic wrap in her entire life.
Really? So what does she do in place of that?
She uses all sorts of things. One really cool and inexpensive, free, actually, method that I learned from her is just to put leftovers in a bowl and put a saucer on top. And the beautiful thing about that is that it's stackable. You can put other things on top of that saucer. So that's just one thing I learned from her. The reason that she doesn't use plastic wrap is not because she's so concerned about the environment, although I think she is. It's because she doesn't want to have to pay for it, It's putting it in a saucer, in a bowl with a saucer on top is free. Having a conversation with someone younger, that's a good point. But, here's one thing. I remember vinyl record albums, and vinyl is a really toxic plastic. Well, then we went to CDs. And CDs are made out of polycarbonate, which has BPA in them. But a lot of the younger people nowadays, they've skipped all that altogether, and they just download MP3s from the internet. And that's what I do now, too. I don't have any plastic. I don't have any music stored on plastic. It's all digital. And so I think in some ways the young people are further ahead. They're definitely getting further ahead when it comes to reducing waste and trying to reduce plastic on their campuses, trying to get their parents to reduce plastic. A lot of times it's the parents that need to be educated.
Now, what about going to the grocery store? Let's do that for a moment. It seems like there's plastic packaging on, you know, a lot of the food that you find there, or even if you're buying a bunch of carrots, you put it in a plastic bag. It seems like it's hard to avoid packaging. What do you do, for instance, when you go grocery shopping?
So I have all sorts of strategies in the grocery store, and I have an entire chapter in my book on grocery shopping. First of all, I try to stick to eating whole foods, not packaged, not processed foods. And you know what? That's so much better, so much healthier anyway. In the produce aisle, you know, a lot of produce you can just buy naked. You don't have to put it in any kind of bag. I put it on the belt without any bag, and it just goes through and then into my reusable bag. If you do want to put it in a bag, there are reusable cotton bags, organic cotton. There are net bags. There are all sorts of things that you can either buy, or some people like to make them themselves. And you can use those instead of a plastic bag. Another thing, farmers markets are awesome. And during the parts of the year when farmers markets are open, I live in California, so we have them year-round. We're really lucky. But in other places, you know, visit the farmers markets whenever they're open, because you can really reduce packaging that way. And then I like to shop in stores that have bulk bins, where I can bring my own bags or bring my own containers and fill them up with all sorts of foods, you know, grains or beans or sugar, flour, whatever I'm buying. Normally I can buy it without any packaging at all.
So, go ahead.
Oh, I was just trying to think what else. I mean, I could go on forever. My husband makes homemade cat food for our cats, and he takes a great big stainless steel bucket to the butcher shop to get the ground turkey for our cats. And it's a real conversation starter every time he goes in there. But, you know, they know him now. They're like, oh, there's the guy with the bucket.
Well, and you do other things, too. Like in your book, you talk about making your own makeup and things like of that nature, because, you know, there's a lot of plastic involved in that. So, I mean, this is more than just getting a different bag for the grocery store.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? I've almost completely reduced the plastic in my bathroom, too. I've found ways to wash my hair without plastic, to brush my teeth without plastic for the most part. I have plastic-free deodorant.
Is it a full-time job to do all this, Beth? It sounds so labor-intensive. The virtuous side of me thinks, that sounds so fantastic. But then the other part of me thinks, I would never have time to do anything else but make my own makeup and cat food and all that stuff.
Okay, first of all, I decided to try to make my own makeup when I was writing the book, because I just wanted to see what was possible. But I am not much of a makeup wearing person in the first place. So I wear very little. And there are a few companies that are making cosmetics that don't come in plastic packaging. And a lot of them you can find on Etsy, ETSY.com. which is a place where individual craftspeople can sell the things that they make. And I have a list in my book also of some of those. I even found mascara, cake mascara, that comes in a little metal tin instead of a plastic tube. So that was sort of the last thing that was difficult to find. But, you know, there are shampoo bars that you can get instead of shampoo in a plastic bottle, and conditioner bars too. I personally use a method called No Poo, which is you wash your hair with a solution of baking soda and water, and you rinse with a solution of apple cider vinegar and water. And that might sound weird, but it works really well, and there's a whole movement of people that swear by this method of hair washing.
Wow.
And I've also discovered that baking soda is the best deodorant I've ever tried. I mean, it just works really well, and I would use it even if I wasn't trying to reduce plastic.
All right. Well, Beth Terry, you've given us a lot to think about, and thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
We've been talking with Beth Terry. She is the author of Plastic Free, How I Kicked the Plastic Habit. and how you can too. If you'd like to read more, she blogs at My Plastic Free Life.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Central Time, I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a possible blackout of this weekend's Green Bay Packer playoff game.
But first, we're talking about tax breaks. On Tuesday, Congress let 55 tax breaks expire, just as they do every year. Some experts say this creates a climate of uncertainty for businesses and organizations who are the beneficiaries of these tax breaks.
Here to talk about how these tax breaks work and why they are renewed from year to year is Robertson Williams. He is the Saul Price Fellow at the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center. And Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Gene. Glad to be with you.
Well, it is good to have you here and help explain some of these things. Now, let's start with the basics and these tax breaks in the first place. As I understand it, these are tax breaks that sort of started at a period of time, not necessarily related to each other, but all wind up expiring at the same time. How did they all wind up here?
Well, Congress over the years has added bits and pieces to our tax code for one reason or another. They want to encourage energy conservation. They want to encourage businesses to invest. They want to allow taxpayers to deduct more things on their income tax. But they're put in piecemeal over time and given short-term lives so they don't cost as much for the budgetary purposes. Congress is trying to balance the budget to keep the debt from rising. And if they pass these pieces of legislation for a year at a time, it doesn't look as big on the budget calculations. In fact, if you do renew them over time, they do cost a lot. But the way they count budgets here in Washington, it's a lot better to pass them 1 year at a time than to pass them and make them permanent.
And politically, I would think it might be an easier sell, too, to say, well, look, it's just going to expire in 2 years, and then you'll have another opportunity to decide whether it's still worth having.
I think that's part of the equation, yes.
So who all is affected by this? I was reading a couple of articles on this, and it really runs the waterfront here. RUM rebates to Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, renewable energy credits, as you mentioned, film producers, teachers who buy classroom supplies. I mean, it really is all over the map.
It is. A number of them are for individuals that we'll see on our income tax returns, but not until we file them in the spring of 2015, the 2014 taxes. A lot of them affect businesses, some very small. If you raise racehorses, for example, or you own a NASCAR racetrack, you get special benefits. As you say, energy conservation. And it's just across the board. Congress has added some of these when the economy was in deep recession to help stimulate the economy and get things going again. Part of it was to help boost the housing market. One of the provisions that's expired is allowing people who sell their homes below the amount they owe the banks to not pay tax on the money the bank didn't charge them. It's the discharge loan, as they call it. Technically, that's income as far as the IRS is concerned, but to help families in distress in this time with all the bad housing market, Congress said, okay, you don't have to pay tax on that. Makes a lot of sense for these people who don't have any money to pay the taxes anyway. But again, that's a temporary thing designed to be temporary because it's aimed at what we hope is a short-term problem in the housing market.
Now, this is not the first time that we've done a story like this about the expiration of these particular tax credits. How has Congress traditionally dealt with this in the past? The tax credits expire, and then what?
Well, Congress tends to wait to the last minute to do these things. We actually were fortunate at the beginning of 2013 because Congress did double duty extending the provisions for 2012 and at the same time saying we'll do it for 2013 as well. And that's those tax provisions that have now expired and we have to worry about 2014. Congress deals with it on a year-to-year basis, both because of the revenue implications, the fact that it looks cheaper to do it on a year-by-year basis, as I said before, and also that the folks who benefit from these provisions lobby hard in the years that's happening, contribute to campaign funds, and it's kind of nice if you're in Congress to have folks coming and saying, asking for favors, and you can ask for favors back, I guess. But that's a political question that I, as an economist, I really shouldn't be answering.
Now, there are some businesses who say that having the tax expiration, you know, having these things expire at the end of the year and every year and then have Congress consider or reconsider or maybe not consider these tax credits creates a climate of uncertainty for business. Is that a real effect, do you think, or is that just more political talk?
I think there is uncertainty for firms, particularly on the ones that look shaky on the face of them. Does it really make sense to give a special depreciation if you're raising racehorses? And if you don't know that that's going to be renewed, then you may not invest the same way you would otherwise. On the other hand, the fact that Congress has renewed them year after year after year makes them look a little less uncertain, a little less temporary than they otherwise would be. And I expect a lot of firms act as if these will be renewed. Of course, they could be in for a shock at some point.
You know, one of the things that this brings up and is the whole idea of tax reform. And we've heard in the past year or so that, you know, well, not just the past year or so, we've heard for some time now that we need some sort of major tax reform. And then when we do stories like this, where there are these bits and pieces of things being affected and not renewed and then will be considered at some point, people always say, what this really points to is a need for some sort of larger reform. Is that your thinking on this, or do you have a different viewpoint?
Well, this is only part of the need for reform. These are the pieces that expire and need to be renewed, but there's a lot of the permanent tax code that one could argue about. Do we really need the alternative minimum tax? Are all the differential rates we have the right kinds of things to have? There are a lot of permanent deductions and credits and exemptions in the tax code that we might want to fix, as well as these temporary ones. One of the things that's going on this year is debating whether we should address the expired tax provisions by themselves or whether we should make them part of a larger tax reform. And the problem with doing the latter, putting them as part of a larger tax reform, is it relies on getting that tax reform done. That's a much heavier lift than passing just the expiring provisions. But it's an issue. You do need a way to pass these expiring provisions. They very rarely are passed on their own. The question is what legislative vehicle do you use in Congress to get these enacted?
Given what's been happening in Congress for the last couple of years in terms of its ability to get things done, is it likely that we're going to see some sort of larger reform? Or, you know, given what just happened, you know, the sort of the baby steps in the budget deal, is now maybe the time to start taking a look at some of these things?
I think the problem with getting tax reform done right now is it is not the kind of thing you do short term, and it does require a very heavy investment from at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. At this point, the Congress has bought in fairly heavily into the idea of tax reform as a concept. Both Dave Camp, who's the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, and Max Baucus, who's the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, have worked hard this last year to put together plans for tax reform, and we're likely to see very specific plans coming from both of those committees this year. At the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, the president has not put a great effort into the tax reform, and until he does invest in that and put the administration's into the equation, it's hard to imagine it ever happening. He has been rather distracted by other issues, as you might know.
And as we get closer to 2016, does it become less likely that we'll see something big happen?
Every time there's an election, there's an issue of what's going to happen. Even this year is that way, with the off-year election coming up in November, with all of Congress and a third of the Senate up for re-election. And that makes it harder. A number of people have said that either we take care of these expiring provisions early in the year or they wait till after the election. The closer you get to the election, the harder it's going to be to pass these things because they then become ammunition for opponents during the election campaign. The same thing then happens in 2016. Your president, to the extent he's going to be involved in any decisions, we'll have a lame duck president getting closer and closer to the end of his term, and the whole question of tax reform will be part of the argument, the debate. debate during the 2016 election.
So given all of that, how do you predict Congress will deal with these cuts this time around? Are they going to be able to do something in the next couple of months?
I think it's really hard to predict what Congress will do at this point. My guess is they'll either try to attach this to something dealing with the debt ceiling, something dealing with extending unemployment benefits for long-time unemployed, things that have to get done early in the year, or they will push them off to the end of the year. I'm hopeful that they'll do it early in the year so that they don't have it hanging like the storm of Damocles over the various taxpayers. But it's really a tough call which way it's going to go this year.
But if they let them go, they could actually make a little money for the Treasury, right?
There's quite a bit of money. It's not going to solve our budgetary problems, but there's quite a bit of money here. On the other hand, doing away with all these things, letting them stay expired, will affect both businesses and a lot of individuals adversely in ways that will not help the economy as we're still trying to recover from the recession.
All right, lots to think about. Bob, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
That was Robertson Williams, a Sol Price Fellow at the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. There are a few universal truths about living in Wisconsin. First of all, summer's always going to be short. It's going to be cold in the winter. And Green Bay Packers tickets are always going to be really hard to get. Isn't that right?
Well, maybe not so fast on that one. As we're seeing, there are still thousands of tickets available for this Sunday's playoff game against the San Francisco 49ers. And if they don't sell soon, a TV blackout could be imposed on the game, which seems like an unthinkable possibility in a Packer-obsessed state.
And that is the topic today of our Curious Wisconsin segment, and we would like to hear from you. What do you make about this news about tickets still being available for that playoff game in Green Bay? Are you planning on enduring the cold and going to the game? And if the game does get blacked out, what are you going to do with your Sunday instead? How are you going to see the game? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org, and we'll be taking your calls in just a few moments.
First, we're joined by Don Walker. He's a reporter and blogger at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he writes the Business of Sports blog. Don, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, it seems kind of crazy to think that thousands of tickets are still available to this game, but apparently that is the status right now. What's your reaction to all that?
Well, I am surprised as well. I heard your intro there talking about certainties in life in Wisconsin. we're going to have cold weather for sure this Sunday, but it is somewhat surprising that there are tickets available, especially for a playoff game, and there are a host of factors to help explain that.
So give us a couple of those factors. My guess is the cold weather has to be at least a major portion of that.
Yeah, I agree. That is clearly emerging as one of the other reasons why people are opting to stay home in their cozy den or living room to watch the game. Latest forecasts that I've seen call for a high of below 7 at 5 o'clock Sunday afternoon. That's barely an hour and a half after the game started. So weather is clearly a big deal. But a lot of fans, season ticket holders, are also loudly complaining about a new ticket policy that was announced at a very bad time, late November. You might recall it was shortly after the Detroit Lions had really cleaned out the Green Bay Packers 40-10. The Packers' playoff prospects looked pretty bleak. The new ticket policy that was announced to season ticket holders said, we'd like you to put money in advance to reserve playoff tickets, and if the Packers don't make the playoffs, we will apply that money to next year's season ticket package. Well, some season ticket holders simply reasoned there was no way the Packers were going to make the playoffs, and they were unwilling to commit that kind of money that late in the season toward playoff tickets. So it looks like they punted and decided not to go after that. That, of course, created an excess of available ticket inventory. As much as 40,000 seats were available by as recently as Monday morning. The Packers are picking away at that, but we're still reportedly at least 5,500 seats short of a sellout.
So what do you think is going to happen? Do you think there actually will be a blackout? Is the NFL bluffing by any chance here?
Well, I don't think they're bluffing, but I've been willing to stake whatever reputation I have, and that is I see it highly unlikely there would be a TV blackout. I think the Packers, and we should know within a moment or so today, whether the NFL grants the team an extension, giving them more time to sell tickets. Absent that, there's other options, I suppose. There could be a title sponsor at Lambeau Field who would agree to buy the remaining inventory, thereby ensuring a sellout and thereby ensuring that all of us who prefer to stay warm on Sunday can watch the game at home.
And a history lesson, if you would, why do we have such a thing as a television blackout anyway?
Well, this was it is a quite old rule imposed by the National Football League, and it was simply imposed in a day where they wanted to fill the stadium, and they felt it was important that the stadium be filled, and if it wasn't, then the fans be damned, and so you were unable to watch a game. And, of course, those were the days, and I remember them well. People would drive 75 miles or more to find a bar, a tavern, or somebody else, some other television market, and watch the game. But most people seem to agree that in this digital era, it's an archaic rule that perhaps ought to end soon.
I got to say, you know, you mentioned the cold weather is a factor here. Isn't that what being a Packers fan is all about? You're hardy, you put on your snowsuit, you paint your face green, you put on your your parka.
Yeah, what happened to the ice bowl, for gosh sakes?
Exactly. Are we going soft?
Yeah, I was just about to say that. I think perhaps we have gotten a little soft. I did a little research this afternoon. The game time temperature for the Ice Bowl on December 31st, 1967 was 13 below. I'm not even sure they had invented wind chill at the time. but more recently, a New York Giants playoff game at Lambeau Field, it was 3 below at game time and a wind chill of 24 below. Unfortunately, the Packers lost that game, but they had a full house. But I do think the advent of, you know, high-end televisions, high-definition televisions, people get a very good game experience at home. That's why you see the Packers and, frankly, any other professional sports franchise market the game experience. They want people to come to the game, obviously, to spend money, and a big house is something that they're always shooting for, but, again, some people are choosing to stay home.
Well, Don, we know you have to go. Thanks so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Don Walker is a reporter and blogger at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And we're taking your calls now at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think of the Packers blackout? Let's go to Joan first in Rudolph. Hi, Joan.
Hi, thanks. My comment is, I don't know if a lot of people know that the NFL League headquarters is a nonprofit organization, so another slap in the face is the American taxpayer gets to pay for, subsidize the NFL. They get all the profit for their $102 million CEO, whatever. And then the home people that subsidize the team, actually, which I believe they are taxed, but the NFL headquarters isn't taxed. They get a lot of the profit and all this thing, too. We subsidize them. We don't get to see the playoff game.
All right. So, Joan, thank you so much for calling up. Joan, hoping, obviously, like a lot of people, that the game will not be blacked out for various reasons there.
800-642-1234, if you'd like to weigh in on this. And we go to Viroqua now, and James is with us. Hi, James.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good. What do you think about all this Green Bay Packer empty seats available for the playoffs thing?
Well, you're gonna have to talk to a Seattleite. Not that I'm a Seattle Seahawks fan, but I've only lived in Wisconsin for about 6 years, so I find the whole fanaticism of the Packers pretty interesting. So I hope nobody remembers that playoff game where, well, whatever.
We remember it. Just trust me when I say that.
Okay. But, yeah, no, I like the Milwaukee reporter's commentary about, you know, it's there's a lot of ways, a lot of things to do on a Sunday afternoon as far as football goes, and the whole game experience is a marketing niche there, and you know, and you got a lot of things that they're fighting. Like, I don't know how many people are wanting to sit out -20 Fahrenheit or whatever, but it'll be interesting to see if they don't sell out. I think it might be a trend of the future, to be honest with you. Like the previous comment of the previous caller was that, you know, it's kind of laughable that the NFL is a multi-million-dollar operation, and they don't really, well, they probably pay some taxes,
but they're a nonprofit.
All right, James, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Milwaukee now, and Ted is with us. Hi, Ted.
Hello?
Hello, Ted. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. I plan on watching the game. I'm not a Green Bay Packer fan. I grew up in Minnesota. But I love playoff football, and if there is a blackout, I will be watching the game on the Internet, several peer-to-peer networks stream the game live, and you can watch pretty much any sporting event live by logging into any of the number of European peer-to-peer networks.
All right, a technical solution to that, and let's go to another phone call now.
Jim in Colfax, you're up, and we've got about 10 seconds. What do you think about it?
Thank you for taking the call. Boo to the non-Packer fan, and I absolutely look forward to getting nice and cold and huddling up with all those Packer fans in the stadium and just having a day I will never forget going to a playoff game.
All right, excellent, Jim. Thanks. We'll leave it on that note. That's doing it for our calls today. Thank you so much for calling us up and telling us what you think.